This is Mike Harris on Republic Broadcasting Network, and this morning is Monday, March 26, 2012. Well, today we finally have Jeff Prager ready to go to talk about the rest of the items in his new book, and we'll have him joining us very, very shortly. I just wanted to take a moment, ask how everyone's weekend was. Hopefully everybody had a nice and restful weekend. There's so much news out there that I don't even know where to start on this. So I'm probably going to pass on the news today and go straight to Jeff as soon as we get him on. But I wanted to let you all know that there's an interesting article by Gordon Duff on Veterans Today, www.veteranstoday.com. And it's about people who should be wearing tinfoil hats. And, you know, that's kind of a joke, you know, between Gordon and I. I think it's kind of funny that he brought that up. But it's a worthwhile article, and it's about the technology of tracking individuals. You know, no matter what you do, no matter where you go, whether you use a debit card or you're under surveillance or but computer systems are in the world now that track every move you possibly make. And, you know, what is the establishment? What is the people going to do? I've just gotten a note that Jeff is ready to go. So good morning, Jeff. How are you this morning?
Good.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. We've got about 3 minutes for our first break. So I want to introduce you. You've written a new book. And why don't you tell us what, you know, the title of it is and where and how people can get the book. That's the one thing we want to do, make sure that the listeners have access to the information you've compiled.
Okay, well, all my books are free, for starters, and I'm kind of a one-man operation, so the graphics and everything, the pictures, everything, the writing, the text, it's just me. And you can find them by going to my Facebook page, which is set at open, so anyone can go there, the CIA, the NSA, or your listeners, and pick up copies of my books. I link them there about every week or so. I'll link a different book. Most recent book is called 9/11, America Nuked, and uses the United States Geological Survey data and the UC Davis Delta Group data, along with some other data, similar data, to track fusion and fission pathways using the various dozens of dust samples taken by these groups, both ground dust and atmospheric dust. Which, following things like yttrium and lanthanum and cerium and thorium and uranium and vanadium and other unusual elements, produces the picture of a human hand in the dust. And we can tell the dust is the best evidence we have. We can tell what happened those days by examining the dust, and that's what we do.
So whenever you say the picture of a human hand, you mean human interference with the creation of the dust?
Absolutely.
Via the chemical signature that's left over from a nuclear explosion.
You bet. We can look at, for example, we can look at the thorium, I mean the strontium and the barium at one particular location, like First and Vesey, I think it is. I'm not real clear on with the streets right now, but I think it was First and Vesey. We can look at the strontium and barium at that location, and we can predict the strontium barium at, let's say, World Trade Center location WTC-01-16, which was a girder column. We can predict the levels at that location and other locations just by knowing the levels at one location, because there's a human hand. The barium and strontium are there. They're there for a reason. It's the same with the vanadium and the zinc and the tritium and yttrium and lanthanum and other chemicals in the dust. You can look at tritium by itself and explain it away rather easily. But you can't look at all of these elements together as they interact with each other and explain them away.
Okay, Jeff, there's our break music, and we'll be back in 3 short minutes. Be right back. Good morning, and welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Republic Broadcasting Network. Today our guest is Jeff Prager. Jeff has written a new book about 9/11 and what really happened versus the fantasy of the government story, which is completely debunked in his new book. So with that being said, Jeff, you know, go ahead and let's take up where we left off before that break.
Okay, you know, I do want to say something, and I think it's really, really critical to say this. I wish I had said it the last time we spoke. The people that perpetrated 9/11, it was obviously an extraordinarily sophisticated operation. And these folks model populations. They can take 307 million Americans and put them into a computer and come out with, you know, answers to questions and, you know, what will they do with this, if this happens or that happens, if Obama's elected or Romney's elected. You know, they can model populations. And so 9/11 being an extraordinarily sophisticated event, one would think that the people that perpetrated 9/11 spent at least the same amount of time devising the system that would be in place after 9/11 to deal with public opinion. They obviously knew ahead of time that people were going to know some of these buildings came down by controlled demolition. And they obviously knew ahead of time that there were going to be some anomalies, that they couldn't, you know, squibs on the building, and just they knew. These folks are sophisticated. They knew ahead of time they would have to manage public opinion. And it's my opinion that they spent even more time than they did planning 9/11 itself on planning after 9/11, post-9/11 public opinion. They knew there'd be 9/11 truth groups, and the strategy was to control those 9/11 truth groups.
Isn't it true that a lot of these 9/11 truth groups are using disinformation just to confuse and muddy the waters?
Sure, I think that's true also. You know, these people can control the message. So you know, look, I don't make a dime on any of my books. I'm a retired publisher, and I have the software that we used to use to publish our magazine. Same software that Newsweek and Time and Playboy and Penthouse and GQ use, the same software everybody uses to make magazines in the industry. So I create my e-magazines at home. I put them on the Internet for free. They're exhaustive research. We're talking about 8 years of research and about a dozen books. Differently than most people write, I use the dust samples. You know, I focus on yttrium and lanthanum and potassium and sodium, and then I follow the money using the Federal Reserve and the Securities and Exchange Commission and federal court records and public banking records and Federal Reserve working papers and things like that, data that can't be questioned. So my books are a little different than anything anybody else does. And they're free. And so I think it would pay for people to at least take a look at them, because I'm not making money on them, and they're researched a little differently than most.
Okay, well, I just want to point out to our audience that because they're free, you're not being bought. You're not being influenced. These are your conclusions reached independently without the pressure of a publisher leaning on you to reach any given conclusion.
Yeah. I put them on half a dozen different web hosting sites. You can get them on Datafile Host. You can get them on Box.net, on Dropbox, on some of the popular, I can't remember the name of the, there's one real popular torrent site that all my books are on. And one
well, let me ask, I'm going to ask you a complex question in three parts. Number one, who did 9/11? Number two, why did they do 9/11? And then number three, how did you reach that conclusion? So that's one question with three parts.
Okay.
So I'll toss that off to you. That'll take you a couple minutes to answer, I think.
Okay, yeah. Who did 9/11 is you know, that's a complex question, but the very basic answer, it was a bankers' convention. HSBC, AIG, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Deutsche Bank, all of the banks across the globe were heavily involved in massive financial frauds of varying types and kinds. And those massive frauds were about to be uncovered by several groups, by the Office of Naval Intelligence, by the El Dorado Task Force, which was a task force of 55 government agencies that were tasked with investigating national and global financial fraud. And all of these offices, the LNI was at the Pentagon, and El Dorado Task Force was in Building 1 and 2 and 7. along with the CIA and other, you know, alphabet groups that were also investigating financial fraud, the loss of $2.3 million at the Pentagon. I mean, the country took these things seriously. Enron, WorldCom, the Kazakhstan gas thing, and the great ruble scam at the Soviet Union. These were all huge financial scams undertaken by bankers for the benefit, in their mind, for the benefit of the American people. But these financial scams couldn't be found out. So that's the basis for 9/11. I mean, that's who did it and why. And then there are benefits to 9/11, the benefits being perpetual war and the Patriot Act and the NNDA and, you know, other things like that.
Wait a minute. Stop. How is perpetual war, the Patriot Act, and the NDAA a benefit? I don't see any benefit at all to the American people on that.
Well, there isn't. There isn't. These people are operating, they're tinged with psychopathy. But it is profitable to them. You see, there's a segment of American society, quite a large one, by the way, that profits enormously, more than anything else, from war. War is the most profitable endeavor undertaken by human beings. And so guys that work in meatpacking plants or manufacture denim or rubber-soled shoes or canvas jackets or pillows or because people think about war as guns and bullets and bombs, there's a whole lot more to keeping 1 million or 2 million soldiers, you know, comfortable in Iraq and Afghanistan and other countries. I mean, these guys have laundry and they got to eat Popeyes and McDonald's and have pizza and play video games and exercise and, you know. So believe me, even the guys making leather belts are making money on war. The guys making shoelaces are making money on war. Believe me. So war is an extremely profitable endeavor, and we have a war economy right now. But you asked, you know, who is the bankers, aided by politicians and unelected and appointed officials and the intelligence community. And when I say the bankers, I want to add a caveat that the global banking community is melded at this point with the global intelligence community. They are one and the same. If you investigate HSBC or Nguyen Bank or some of the other, even AIG, you'll see that these are just covers for intelligence operations, and they all work very closely together and are one and the same. So who is the bankers, you know, via the intelligence community and the elected and unelected leaders? Why is because numerous financial crimes of vast proportions were about to be revealed, and that couldn't be. And then how? Was that the third part? Was how?
The first of all, it was the who, the why, and then the how did they pull it off? I mean, what did they actually do? How did they snooker the American people into, you know, they detonated nuclear weapons on American soil in New York City. And how did they get away with this? How big of an operation? What kind of cover up was entailed to manage the, as you said, the public opinion, to keep people from rioting in the streets?
Well, I think it was very, very small. I think everything was just minimal. The military industrial complex wants to use minimal effort for maximum gain. They don't want to put 300 people out there wiring up a building and you know, 300 more wiring up a second building and 30 more wiring up a third building, and I mean, they just don't operate like that, you know. So one guy changing out computers on every 10th floor, not even knowing that there's a little micronuclear device the size of a small apple inside that computer, he could change out a computer on every 10th or 15th floor in a day or two, and he's now loaded the buildings with the explosives.
Well, let me ask you a question on that, because you read Dmitry Kalikov's work. I have too. And Dmitry alleges that there was nukes built in World Trade Center in the basement.
Sure. I wrote a book to support Dmitry's theories. This was some time ago, but, you know, I also continued to investigate this further. Dmitry was a part of my entry into the nuclear theory, not all of it, but a good part of it, and I did write a book supporting his, because his was kind of Russian-English. I wrote one in English, so it was easier to understand for people. But I don't disagree. I don't agree with Dmitry's final analysis. I agree that it was a nuclear event because I can see it in the dust with the physicists I work with. We can follow the decay paths. But we disagree that it was a singular device underground, not because it wouldn't work and not because Dmitry's theory doesn't work. It does, because of the quantities of the elements in the dust. In other words, the amount of vanadium and the amount of zinc and the amount of uranium and the amounts of the other elements in the dust, we don't think it was a single bomb, nor do we think it was the size that Dmitry estimates. In any event, you know, going back to what you said, so one guy could have loaded the buildings. All of the bombs could have been lit sequentially, electronically from, you know, 2 miles away by one person.
Well, you know, our break music is coming up, and we'll take this right back up within 3 minutes. Stick with us, folks. Well, good morning. This is Mike Barrett from the Public Broadcasting Network, and today our guest is Jeff Prager. And Jeff, welcome back to the show, and let's pick up where we left off, where we were talking about how they did this and how few people it took to actually pull this thing off.
Okay, well, you know, I mentioned the military-industrial complex, or anyone for that matter, whoever you might think did this, you know, they want the biggest bang with the least amount of effort. And, you know, wiring a building with, you know, 100 or 300 people over months of time is just not how they work. One guy with a micronuclear device the size of an apple inside of a computer disguised as a component of that computer, you know, one guy could change out a computer on every 10th or 15th floor, which is all it would take, in just a matter of a day or two. And he wouldn't even have to know there was a nuclear device inside the computers he was changing out. And now we have the buildings loaded, and they can be lit sequentially in nanoseconds from miles away. So, you know, that's the way I would if I were General, you know, Joe, whoever, were going to wire the buildings. That's what I would do. Certainly we have the technology to do that. Now let's look at the thermite, just momentarily look at the thermite versus a nuclear device that's the size of an apple. Dr. Harrod and Dr. Jones have an energetic compound of thermite that we know everything about. The Bentham Physics Journal, Open Physics Journal PDF tells us everything about it. It has a 300 meter per second velocity. As compared, just by the way, RDX and TNT and HMX are all in the 9,000 meter range, so their energetic compound is a very slow burning incendiary. It's not an explosive. It only burns at 300 meters per second velocity. Their estimate in an email to T. Mark Hightower and others was that they needed a minimum of 29,000 metric tons up to 144,000 metric tons of their energetic compound per building. I promise you, using their minimum, if you lit 29,000 metric tons of a 300 meter per second energetic compound in a building that was 1,000 feet tall and burned it all in less than 10 seconds, you would see that from Beijing. The flash would be so bright. Now, a 6-inch nuclear...
If you look at the supply chain issues on that, if you had 29,000 tons, there'd be a supply chain, there'd be a trail. Someone would know where it came from.
Well, you know, I did the estimates with trucking companies. It would have taken 1,500 tractor trailers to move 29,000 tons. And if you could move one box from the tractor trailer to its final destination every 15 minutes, working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, it would have taken 100 days just to load the building with the material. So I don't think it's plausible or possible. But in any event, a nuclear device that was, let's say, 6 inches across, the flash of that device would be in a nanosecond. In fact, standard nuclear devices, the ones most people are familiar with, those have two flashes. And the first flash you can't see. That's how fast it happens. Most of those have two flashes. The first flash we record with photographic equipment, but we can't see it. It's too fast for the human eye.
Mm-hmm.
But with a little 6-inch tritium, deuterium, tritium device with a little bit of uranium in it, then, you know, it might weigh, you know, it might be 6 inches across, it might weigh 40 pounds, 30, 40, 50 pounds, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's done in a nanosecond. You know, in a nanosecond, there's a tritium-deuterium reaction. That's done. In the next nanosecond, there's the reaction, the fission begins with uranium. And then, you know, in the third nanosecond, the whole thing's blown into space, and virtually the fusion virtually stops, and the fission continues minimally. But the flash, you know, nobody's going to see the flash in a 100-story building. You could light those off. You could light one of those mini nukes off every 10, 15 floors, and nobody would see anything but the building turning to dust and falling down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what we saw. You know, and again, you know, people throw away the dust. But if you look at the potassium and the sodium, even just the potassium and sodium, which are stable isotopes of decay paths, they're the stable isotopes. The potassium and sodium are high enough in the dust that we know a nuclear event took place just on the quantity of potassium and sodium in the dust alone. We can look at the uranium and see that a nuclear event took place the level.
If you remember back when 9/11 first happened, you still remember that they were talking about pools of molten metal beneath the surface that had molten metal there for weeks.
Yes.
How do we account for that?
Well, let's see how the energetic compound crowd accounts for it. Energetic compounds do not require oxygen to burn. They create their own oxygen. And so the energetic compound crowd believes that residual unburned energetic compound underground fueled those fires. There's a distinct problem with that. Energetic compounds are created at nanoscale for a particular reason. And that reason is to make them rapid burners. The faster they burn, the higher the temperature they can reach.
Okay, well there's our break music again. We'll be right back in 3 minutes.
Okay.
Well, good morning and welcome back. This is Mike Harris on your public broadcasting network, and it's Monday, March 26, 2012. We're on with Jeff Prager, and he's sharing with us his latest research and data on the real story behind 9/11. And what really happened and how. So, you know, Jeff, the microphone is yours.
Okay, so, you know, we're talking about how does the energetic compound 9/11 group explain the fires at Ground Zero. We know from UC Davis, the Delta group, Professor Cahill, who's an atmospheric nuclear professor, nuclear physicist, we know that on October 30th, he was seeing aerosols made out of glass with soot on them. So we know that the temperature had to exceed 2355 C, which is the boiling point of glass. And that was on October 30th, about 50 days after 9/11. He had some aerosol monitoring equipment on the roof, very sophisticated equipment, by the way, the most sophisticated aerosol monitoring equipment that exists, designed by him, up on the roof monitoring the aerosols, the atmospheric aerosols. So we know the temperature on the 30th of October was 2355 C. The thermite crowd believes that thermite, which generates its own oxygen, does not need oxygen to burn. It'll burn underwater. It'll burn underground easily. Generated its own oxygen and kept these fires going. The problem with that is that thermite, by definition, nanothermite, by definition, is mixed at nanoscale. And the reason it's mixed at nanoscale is very specific. It's mixed at nanoscale to make it burn as fast as humanly possible, so that when you light up a pound of nanothermite, that pound of nanothermite burns in just a millisecond or two. It's gone. It uses up all its fuel. The flash is as bright as the sun. And so to think that unburned energetic compound would be continuing to burn for 50 days underground is absolutely absurd.
Let me ask the corollary question to that then. If there was liquid metal under the WTC site, what liquefied it, and what was, you know, how did that stay liquid for so long? Because they were talking about liquid metal under the site
sure.
for months afterwards.
I just told you how the thermite crowd answers that. They answer it with thermite, but it's not possible. How that metal remained liquid that length of time after the event, and we do have not only film, but visual testimony from people. I can't remember the organization, but it's in one of my books.
I remember the firefighters complaining that their boots were melting within minutes.
And that too. But we have solid data on melted metal well after the event. Very, very secure data on that. So how? Well, unfissioned material. A deuterium-tritium fusion device produces a lot of tritium, which dissipates rapidly from rain and water. And remember now, we had 30 million gallons of water plus another 10 million of rain. And it produces a little tiny bit of uranium. And we did have double the amount of uranium we should have had in the girder coatings based on the USGS data. So that's how we have, when you light off, you know, a dozen or two very small micronuclear devices. Most people don't know this, but all nuclear devices, they don't explode all their material. They only use about 4% of the fissile material. The explosion happens so quickly that about 4% of the fissile material gets used, and 96% of it gets blown to bits all over where the explosion takes place. It just blows itself up. Only uses 4% of its material. So with a deuterium-tritium device, a fusion device, as the ignition source for the fission reaction, you get a lot of tritium, which we had at ground zero, 55 times the normal level. And then you get a very little bit of uranium, which we also had double the normal level. And that with that many of those complex fusion-fission devices, you would have a certain amount of unfissioned, fissionable material remaining at ground zero and continuing to fission, which would explain the increased level of uranium in the girder coating dust taken by the USGS, which was well over double what it should be normally on a girder inside of a 1,000-foot building. How the uranium got on that girder, that's a good one. I know how it got there, but I'd like to hear other people explain that one away. So in any event, unfissioned material is what maintained those fires. Those fires had 1,200 gallons of pyrocool poured on them. And in my latest book, I have 6 pages devoted to the technical aspects of pyrocool from the company that manufactures pyrocool itself, with samples of about 40 different or 50 different fires that pyrocool was used on. This stuff puts fires out in 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 8 seconds, 1 second, less than 1 second. Enormous fires of all types of fuels. It puts them out immediately. Every time pyrocool is used, the fire goes out, and it goes out in seconds, and it had no effect on ground zero fires.
So it's a different type of fire than pyrocool had encountered before.
It was fissioning material, and nothing can stop fission.
Okay.
There is nothing that can stop the fission process. It has to complete its process, and it gets to a stable isotope like the potassium and sodium, and it's done.
You want to talk about some other anomalies, but before we go on to the other anomalies, I want to ask you about the financial anomalies, because a lot of people made a lot of money a lot of different ways, you know, short selling, shorting airline stocks, as documented. What other financial anomalies have you encountered and have you unearthed through your research?
Well, I think there's one really fascinating one that I think nobody knows about, and I think it's imperative that they do, because there's proof. You have to remember, again, I try to use credible proof to come to conclusions. So, let's just assume that I'm correct and that $240 billion worth of fraudulently derived bonds, American bonds, were due on September 12th. So the U.S. government needed to come up with $240 billion on the 12th to pay out these bonds, and it was going to be exposed who owned the bonds and who was turning them in, and you know where they originated, and you know that was just data that couldn't come to the surface. So if you look at what the SEC did, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and there's a picture of this this picture webpage in my book and another one also. The SEC implemented an act on September 12th. I can't remember the number of the act right offhand. I might be able to find it while we're talking. But in any event, they threw up a new act on the internet on the 12th of September 2001, and that act allowed all securities in the United States to trade anonymously. Meaning, if you had, I have both of them right here. Let me see if I can get them opened. If you had $1 billion in bonds, you could receive your $1 billion from the financial system in the United States, and you could do so anonymously. Your name and address did not have to be revealed. Then that was done on the 12th. Then on the 14th, they issued another act that extended the one on the 12th. So for a total of 15 days from September 11th to September 26th, all securities in the United States were allowed to clear anonymously. Now, this is a significant part of 9/11, and I go into it in depth in my book. I can't do that on the radio here. There's not enough time. But there's a reason that the SEC allowed bonds to clear anonymously, and I can give you, I've got them right here. This one is, this is the one on the 14th, I think, where they extended the first one, and this is Securities and Exchange Act, release number 44791, released on September 14th, 2001, titled Emergency Order Pursuant to Section 12K2 of the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934, taking temporary action to respond to market developments. This is complex financial material, but if you've got people that can understand these things and read them, so there was that one, and then there's, this is the one on September 16th, and it's number 44797. So the first one is, Securities Exchange Act, release number 44791, and 44797 is what they would want to look at if they can find those. They're in my books, but they might find them on the internet also. I'm sure they will. So I think it's important to note that, and then to look at also, if you look at there's another financial anomaly, and that's that the Bank of New York was short for one day on a $1 billion payout. And I'd have to reread the material because I'm not as familiar. I'm into the elements right now and this financial stuff I wrote about a couple of years ago. But there's an anomaly attached to that where the Federal Reserve is involved also, where we can show a connection to 9/11 and that one. It was a payment bubble the day after 9/11. It was a 9/12 $1 billion payment bubble at the Bank of New York.
Well, then we have the very famous Donald Rumsfeld speech, which he gave on September 10th, telling that the Pentagon was missing $2.3 trillion worth of money that they couldn't account for.
Exactly, and to be honest with you, a year later, Dove Zakheim, who at that time was in Rumsfeld's position, maybe a little more than a year later, but sometime later, he announced another $1.1 million was missing during his tenure at the Pentagon. The problem is this, is that the Pentagon is usurping funds, and they're doing it legally. I wrote a book called, it was the CIA or NSA, or I can't remember the name of it offhand, but it was a financial investigation of the CIA and HUD. And the CIA, and I show where the CIA confiscated about $1 trillion from HUD. And I prove it. I prove it factually. And they do it legally. I even show the legislation that allows them to do it. The CIA can take public funds from public organizations legally. the legislation's enacted. It was enacted a long time ago. But that's one of the problems, is the CIA is usurping all this money all over the place for covert action and you know, for the great patriotic and nationalist benefit of the American people. And then the government has to cover it all up. You know, it's kind of laughable, I guess, but it's sad at the same time.
Well, I'm getting emails from you from a regular listener named Dave, who's telling me what a great guest and how much he's enjoying it. He said 29,000 tons is 58 million pounds. There's no way they could use thermite. So I just wanted to pass that along. I know Dave's a regular listener, and I want to thank him for listening.
Sure. You know, thermite's impossible. Thermite could have been used. Energetic compound, let's use that term. A nano-energetic compound would have worked. But the nano-energetic compound possessed by Stephen Jones that has a velocity of 300 meters per second would be okay for lighting a steak in the barbecue in my backyard. But it is a slow incendiary. It is not even classified as an explosive.
Right.
So if we want to talk about Stephen Jones, we need to talk about his thermite.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the other anomalies that you found, because I want to get as much new information out to our people as possible.
Okay, I have many. Which one was this?
Any one you want. I'll let you pick. It's guest.
Okay.
So why don't you prioritize them and tell us which ones you think are the most important that the listeners know about.
Well, they're all so important. I wouldn't know where to even begin. I think, if we want to get down to anomalies that have the best supportive data, the single best supportive data is the uranium, okay? Uranium occurs in everybody's backyard. Every one of your listeners has uranium in their backyard. It's in their front yard, too. They can go grab some dirt. It's going to be in the dirt. We know that uranium is at a level of a low of 12 becquerels per kilogram to a maximum high of 40 becquerels per kilogram on the planet. That's what we see, 12 to 40 becquerels per kilogram, no less, no more. That's the range. But on a girder, from the inside of the World Trade Center, taken a dust sample from the outside of a box column girder, taken on September 16th, we get 93 becquerels per kilogram uranium, or
125% of what the maximum should be.
It is more than double. It's 125% more, greater than what the maximum should be. On a girder coating from inside a 1,000-foot building that exploded and fell down. How do you explain that? I mean, please tell me, how do you explain? I mean, I can explain it. I can't even explain it. I could explain it within a mile or two of Three Mile Island or any of the nuclear plants, perhaps, in the United States. I could explain a slight increase in uranium. Not 93 becquerels per kilogram, maybe 50, 60, maybe even 65, but not 93.
Let's talk a little bit then about, you know, how did these SOBs think they could get away with it? Let's go back to how they control the 300-plus million American mines that are out there. That how do they get away with it? How do they dupe us into believing their official story?
Well, you know, Mike, I probably have an unpopular opinion on that particular subject, but I'm not afraid to talk about it.
Okay.
The fact is that the material that we're discussing right now. For instance, that 93 becquerels per kilogram of uranium were found in the dust, which was then again translated from the USGS data, which actually was parts per million, which came to 7.57 parts per million.
Yeah, Jeff, I hear our break music coming up
okay.
here.
And I do want to answer that.
Okay, we'll be back, and I'll give you 4 minutes. Good morning. This is Mike Harris.
the Republic Broadcasting Network, and it's Monday, March 26, 2012. We're on with Jeff Prager. This is our final segment. So, Jeff, I'm going to give you the last word on this. So,
okay. You know, Mike, you asked me a pointed question. You asked, you know, how do these people get away with this? How could they think they could get away with it? I do want to first say they did get away with it. So how could they think they could? And here's the answer to that. I've been at this for 8 years. The complexities of learning to understand what happened, whether you look at the financial aspects or the elemental aspects, the lanthanum and uranium and elements, the sodium, potassium in the dust, either of those aspects are year-long, tedious, grueling investigations of boring material, Federal Reserve working papers and Securities and Exchange Acts and federal court motions and answers to motions and judges' orders, and then the science of tritium and the deuterium-tritium fusion. And, I mean, it's so complex that the average person is not going to understand it. And you can come up with the real term being metastable intermolecular sol gels. You can come up with a word like superthermite and grab the world. And everybody stops investigating. They stop looking. They dead stop. It's superthermite. We got it. We're done. And, you know, that's how they do. That's how they operate.
Let me point a couple things out to you. You have to remember that half our population is below average. Other half is above average. And if the average guy out there doesn't take the time, you know the below average guy is not going to take the time.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. I mean, I can make sense out of this because I, you know, began an endeavor to find out what happened. And it was for me. I wanted to know what happened. I was retired. I had the time. And I decided to look at this, you know, from an angle that others hadn't used, that seemed safer bets to me. Using the dust and using the financial aspects. But man, it was grueling. I mean, grueling. This was a grueling experience. It was like going back to a physics college class and a political science classes and actually attending class and getting A's. It was hard. So I don't see the average person, you know,
even
having the time.
What can we tell our listeners, those who out there who want to see justice brought to the world, justice brought to these perpetrators? Any advice you can give them on what they can do to turn up the heat, to turn up the pressure, to do something that will help bring these scoundrels to justice?
Well, you know, I hate to plug my books, but I don't mind because I don't make a dime on them. They're all free. And, you know, 3, 4, 5 of my books provide all of the necessary data for indictments and convictions. I mean, I name people. I mean, I name people that nobody's familiar with, but they definitely were involved in 9/11, and I show their connections. In fact, I even have pictures of them. There's pictures of 100 people in my forensic financial investigation, and then there's pictures of another 100 in the book that's subsequent to that that finishes that one up. And everybody's named and pictured, and I mean, the data's there.
Okay, well, folks, we're running out of time. This is our last minute. I hear our break music. I want to thank you, Jeff, for being on it as a guest again. And we'll talk to you again soon. This is Mike Harris. Talk to you tomorrow. Bye-bye.